Welcome to Multiple Myeloma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Edward Stadmauer from the Abramson Cancer Center of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and to begin, he commented on one of the most exciting developments in the field, the use of CAR T therapy.
Well, as you know, immunotherapy for myeloma has actually been going on for perhaps the last 20 years. Myeloma is a disease of immune dysregulation, and there are abnormal T cells and B cells. And in many ways, the first real demonstration of success of immunotherapy were the immunomodulatory agents, lenalidomide and thalidomide and pomalidomide. Certainly, we know that there is an aspect of how those work by directly targeting the myeloma cells, but I think a great extent, and the reason why they're called immunomodulatory agents, is because they are stimulating the microenvironment of the bone marrow of patients with myeloma, and that's really a major aspect of how they work. We've been trying for a long time to make vaccines to stimulate an anti-immune response, immunologic response. The problem is the vaccines that we've used, these single antigen-directed vaccines, have just not, they've definitely demonstrated immune responses, but the clinical responses have been very minimal. So one of the major developments has been these genetically modified T cells. And as you know, the target of the T cell is really one of the major first points of how to make these things work. And the logical initial target for cancers was CD19, the marker that's on most of the B cells. And so the CART19 or the CD19 directed genetically modified T cells, I think it was back in 2011, was the first time that bringing together molecular biology, creating these chimeric antigen receptors, inserting them into viral vectors, and then infecting a person's own T cells to modify the cells so that they put on their surface this warhead, was demonstrated to really be successful first in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and then acute lymphocytic leukemia and then non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The problem is as B cells differentiate, they lose the CD19. And so in multiple myeloma, most of the cells are not CD19 positive. So there has been a search for other targets for multiple myeloma. And the most promising one that has come out is called the BCMA, the B cell maturation antigen. So this marker is on the surface of most plasma cells and most malignant plasma cells. So as the B cells differentiate, there's less CD19 and more BCMA. And so over the last couple of years, there's now been very exciting results where a patient's own T cells are removed. They're genetically engineered to put an anti-BCMA warhead on their surface. And then simply infusing these cells into patients with relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma, in some experiments, maybe half of the patients have had beautiful responses. And in some of the recent reports, the majority of patients have had nice responses. So in our particular institution, we have a patient now who had relapsed and refractory disease, where was basically a patient who was dying of myeloma. And we simply infused these genetically engineered T cells. And within a month, the patient went from having active myeloma to complete remission. And that was 18 months ago. And the patient is still in a strict complete remission 18 months later with very minimal side effects, though there are potential toxicities to these therapies. The most notable one is that cytokine release syndrome where patients can get an inflammatory response as these T cells proliferate in their system that mimics sepsis. So patients can have low blood pressure and fever and respiratory distress. But fortunately, for most patients, this is a self-limiting process. And we actually have the antidote of the CRS, which is an IL-6-driven inflammatory inflammatory process, and tocilizumab, which is a medication that lowers the levels of interleukin-6, miraculously sort of reverses this syndrome within hours in the vast majority of patients.
I wanted to ask you about both aspects of the things that you're talking about, both the efficacy as well as the toxicity. But as long as you just brought up the toxicity, another thing we've heard a lot about are CNS issues. What has been seen there, and what's the pathophysiology, also cytokine release?
You know, CNS issues, delirium, seizures, confusion, these are real potential side effects. We do not really understand the mechanism of this. We've seen similar symptoms in patients getting the other anti-CD19 monoclonal antibody, blinatumomab. In general, these are self-limiting and reversible, but there have been some fatalities from the CNS toxicity. But we don't understand the CNS toxicity as well, and we don't clearly have an antidote for it as well as the CRS.
So I mentioned to you that David Porter from your institution, who's done so much of the work in this field, particularly in leukemia and lymphomas, is actually working with us on a program right now. And I'd interviewed him a couple of years ago when he told me some of the stories of the initial patients, some of the cytokine release syndromes and severe problems that were seen. I've heard it said that this is less with BCMA. Is that true in myeloma?
Well, you know, the experience is still much less with BCMA and myeloma, and so it's still an evolving story. And I would say that we have definitely seen some significant CRS in our myeloma patients. You know, I think there is a relationship between the burden of the disease and probably some relationship, though it's not clear, between the success and how well the cells are popping from the therapy about the incidence of CRS. But you're correct that some of the reports have really shown relatively minimal toxicities, and we'll still have to see. I mean, I think that currently the use of CAR T cells for myeloma is exciting, but it still remains experimental. I think we have a lot of proof of principle and that there are certainly patients who've had nice responses, but I think that we're now in an engineering aspect of this where we really have to figure out what are truly the best targets and how the best way of targeting the myeloma cells. There seems to be a lot of relationship between the expansion of these cells within the patient's body and how well to maximize the expansion of these cells and persistence. It really seems like these cells need to stay in a person's body for a while so they can act as a, well, Carl June, who was our great physician scientist at Penn who has done a lot of this work, he calls them serial killers, that you want to keep them around at low levels so that should the antigen, meaning the disease, start growing again, that they'll be around to proliferate and attack and get rid of the disease.
So you mentioned the issue of IL-6 blocking with tocilizumab. When you see a patient having cytokine release, do you go right to that or you use corticosteroids and then if it doesn't work, you bring it in?
We try to avoid medications that will kill the T cells unless we really have to. We sort of keep that in our back pocket. If we really get a sense that these T cells are proliferating and causing lots of toxicity and our routine mechanisms or approaches to try to improve the patient are not working, then we'll go quickly to steroids. And we have had the greatest success. We had this one patient who had a horrible CNS toxicity where she basically became obtunded, and it was somewhat clear that the engineered T cells were proliferating in her CNS. And for her, we simply gave her a dose of cyclophosphamide. And within hours of that, the process reversed and she actually woke up completely and had one of the best responses that we saw to it. But currently, we tend to use these approaches only sort of as a last resort. There is some debate as to whether the tocilizumab is in any way anti-effective. And there are some studies which are using it right from the get-go to see if they can eliminate the CRS without ameliorating the response rate. But that remains an experiment. Our approach has always been to be ready with the medication, but to not use it unless it's really needed.
So I'm curious, your patient that you referred to had this great response. What kind of toxicity issues, if any, did he have?
Well, the average time to have a toxicity from the infusion of the cells is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1 to 2 weeks after the infusion. And he did require, we're very quick. We actually do these treatments as outpatients, but then we're very quick to admit the patient should they have any signs of sepsis or the CRS syndrome or CNS toxicity. And so he did require admission and actually experienced what we call a grade 3 CRS and did receive tocilizumab, in fact, received 2 doses of it approximately in that first week of therapy. But recovered from that, did fine, and has not had any clear toxicity from the treatment since then.
What actually happened? You had a fever or what clinically?
Yes. So fever is usually the first sign of some sort of toxicity. Sometimes it's actually the CRS. Sometimes, like any other infusion of sort of activated cells, you can get a transfusion or an infusion reaction that can be the issue. But he had low blood pressure. He had some hypoxia, he required some oxygen, and low blood pressure, and fever. So fever, low blood pressure, hypoxia, pretty classic. And there are serum markers that suggest this cytokine release syndrome. It's a macrophage activation syndrome, so the ferritins tend to rise. And CRP, you know, the C-reactive protein, is a surrogate for interleukin-6, and that tends to rise too. And his numbers did go up along with these symptoms. And then with the infusion of tocilizumab, very quickly, the symptoms resolved.
Did he have any CNS issues?
Well, I would say he had mild ones. You know, it's always tricky when you have fevers to 103.
Right.
You know, whether if you're a little bit confused or lethargic, is that a CNS problem or is it just related to the symptoms?
I was going to ask you, most of these are sort of generalized, not focal neurologic problems?
Correct.
Fascinating. So, of course, the thing everybody wants to know is where do we stand right now in terms of efficacy? How many people have you actually treated at Penn?
So we still have an ongoing phase 1 trial, and we have somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20 patients that have been treated. But the cohort that we've reported is actually a very remarkable cohort. It's a group of patients, 9 patients, were the first group of patients, where we're one of the few centers that decided we'd like to try just to give the T cells. Most of these genetically modified T cell protocols first give the patient what we call lymphodepleting chemotherapy, a slug of cyclophosphamide or fludarabine to sort of eliminate the innate T cells so that we can then infuse cells into a empty bone marrow that then will proliferate these cells. But we wanted to have at least our first cohort without any of that lymphodepleting therapy to really sort of separate any potential response from the lymphodepleting therapy versus the infusion of the cells. So this patient that I've been describing and 9 other patients just received an infusion of the cells without any lymphodepleting therapy. In our experience, and I guess another thing that's different from our experience than a lot of the other studies, is we also did not assay the patients for BCMA expression. Since in our experience, virtually every plasma cell or every patient with myeloma has BCMA expression, we decided that we would just infuse all comers and then use that to help see if we can differentiate who might have the best responses and see if there's anything that can be correlated with that. So anyway, this first group of 9 patients just received the cells, were not selected, and were very heavily pretreated. And nevertheless, 44% of those patients had a very nice response, including, I guess, our star patient and our first patient, which is now 18 months in this strict complete remission, doing great.
Any estimate of the total number of patients that have been presented or reported at this point, and globally what we know about it in terms of efficacy?
Well, you know, I just came back from the ASCO meeting where there was an update of one group of studies from what they call the Bluebird group, and then another group of studies from China, actually. And China, basically the United States and China, are the primary countries where this activity have been done. And both the Bluebird results and the Chinese results were very remarkable, very high response rates and relatively low toxicities, as you suggested. They report low incidences of the CRS, but both of them are relatively preliminary reports. I would say in terms of numbers, we're talking about 100 or fewer patients that have been treated with this anti-BCMA cellular immunotherapy. But certainly the preliminary results are very promising, though much more work needs to be done. In virtually all the studies that have been presented so far, the infusion of these cells has been done in patients who are really very relapsed and refractory. You could argue, given that this is an immunotherapy approach, that maybe a more intact immune system, as would be seen in an earlier group of patients, or perhaps a less refractory and resistant malignant myeloma cell, may even be more amenable to this sort of therapy. And so studies are beginning in an earlier group of patients.
You know, you correctly said that a lot more work needs to be done. On the other hand, it also brings up an issue that's happening a lot in oncology, where you see a novel therapy that's given by itself, and you start seeing people who have no options, you know, regaining their health, so to speak, like your patient. And from a, I guess, regulatory perspective, what's it take to get that in practice? Oncologists may wake up and see that it's approved. I would guess that it's only going to be approved to be utilized in specialized centers, but it kind of gets into the overall issue of, you know, I mean, how many people would you need to see to want to give this therapy? You're talking about 100, whatever, 200, whatever. And then if that does become available, do we have the capacity to treat all the patients, and who's going to treat them? At this point, do you think that community-based oncologists can manage these patients?
I think there's a learning curve, like any new therapy. Right now, I would say cellular therapy is in the realm of maybe an autologous bone marrow transplant, that it will be helpful to have some comfort level and expertise with patients potentially having a sepsis syndrome, having the ability to admit the patients to the hospital, have some rapid turnaround of blood work so you can see what's happening. And so, of course, initially, the centers that will be doing cellular therapy, I think, are the same sort of tertiary centers where you refer for autologous transplant or stem cell transplant. But I think that will be how it starts. But just like any other therapy and technology, as the community becomes more and more comfortable with it, and as standard operating procedure protocols become more and more clear, I think that definitely community physicians and community hospitals, the same hospitals that are doing leukemia induction therapy or inpatient infusional chemotherapies for lymphoma, let's say, I can't see why those physicians wouldn't do a fine job of caring for these patients.
That's an interesting thought, though. In other words, obviously, there are transplant centers in the community.
Correct.
That maybe it'll be the transplant centers that this kind of starts through cellular therapy. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, but now remember, currently, certainly at Penn, and we sort of generate these cells ourselves at our institution, but for most of the studies, the cells are being generated at a central facility that's external to the institution. And really, all you need at your institution is the capability of doing a peripheral blood lymphocyte collection, sending the lymphocytes to whatever central facility. The central facility is what's creating the cells and engineering the cells. And then they send back, currently, they send back a frozen bag that's much smaller than a packet for autologous transplant. And once the cells have been engineered and frozen, they're good for a period of time before they need to be utilized. So really, I think, you know, as that process gets greased, I think that it will be a relatively straightforward process in terms of collecting the cells and administering the cells. I think there needs to be standard procedures for how to give what type of lymphodepleting therapy, where to give the lymphodepleting therapy, There should be standard ways of monitoring these patients with ferritins and CBCs, et cetera. And again, as with anything, there's going to be a learning curve with the first patient or so, but I think after a while, you become very comfortable. Dr. Porter, who you mentioned, he and his team has done a really good job of analyzing the toxicities, particularly the CRS, has developed a whole algorithm of how to manage the cytokine release syndrome and how to observe it. And I think that's really become a standard practice throughout, not just at Penn, but throughout the institutions that have been doing this work.
I remember a couple of years ago, we were doing a symposium on melanoma when the combination data of ipilimumab and nivolumab was coming out, and everybody was like, oh, can we do this in the community? And of course, now people kind of do it routinely. So as you say, there really is a capability to handle complicated therapies. Where do you think this is going to land? You know, when you talk about immunotherapy in general, people are always thinking about the concept of upfront. I know we're a long way from that.
Sure.
But could you envision upfront cellular therapy?
Yeah, so, and exactly what you say, sometimes we confuse all of this. So remember, we've got cellular immunotherapy is what we're talking about. What we haven't spoken about is, you know, there's other forms of immunotherapy, just as the checkpoint inhibitors have been very active in solid tumors. More and more, we're seeing that the checkpoint inhibitors are active in myeloma, usually not as a single agent, but in combination, particularly with the immunomodulatory agents. Those combinations have been very active. And there's some suggestion that adding checkpoint inhibition to the cellular therapies might even further improve those. But this is still a hope rather than a proven thing. But if we find that these cellular therapies really can overcome resistance and really eliminate every single malignant cell, then obviously it has the potential of being the brass ring, that this will be something that if you give it early to the patients, we talk a lot about the genetic biology of myeloma cells and how certain genetics lead to much more resistant clones. Well, when you're targeting something that's on the surface of every one of these malignant cells, then it almost doesn't matter what's inside the cell if it really is capable of destroying every cell that it attacks. And then if it can persist and be a serial killer, then doing this sort of therapy early in the course of the disease may be a way of really leading to long-term remissions in these patients. But that, of course, remains to be determined.
So I want to go through your cases. And the first one I want to ask you about is this 54-year-old man who's a pharmacist. But before you go through the case, I see that he got daratumumab, and before we get into that, I'm just thinking about what you were saying about immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, and cellular therapy. What's your vision about how daratumumab and elotuzumab work?
Well, ever since rituximab was created and found to be effective for B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, of course, we've been looking for the rituximab for every disease that we can find. And in particular, myeloma just really being another B-cell malignancy, we've been looking for a rituximab for myeloma. And just like with the cellular therapy, BCMA is a logical target for plasma cells. And in fact, there are anti-BCMA monoclonal antibodies that are under current investigation. And in fact, they've latched immuno sort of conjugates, so toxins, to anti-BCMA and have seen very remarkable responses with that sort of work. But the more common markers that are on myeloma cells include the CS1 or the SLAMF7 antigen, as well as a CD38 antigen. In fact, CD38 is one of the ways that we use flow cytometry to isolate and identify plasma cells. So looking for or creating antibodies, and both the CS1, the SLAMF7, and the CD38 in particular are primarily on plasma cells. I mean, that's one of the key ingredients or criteria for being a good target. It has to be something that's primarily on the tumor cell and not particularly on other cells. And so with the CS1-SLAMF7, the elotuzumab monoclonal antibody, which was really the first one that was being used, as a single agent, it had actually very little activity. But when, again, combined with immunomodulatory agents, lenalidomide in particular, there's been a very nice randomized trial that shows clear improvement in response and particularly survival when elotuzumab is added to the lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Exactly what aspect of how that's working is really the primary aspect. We still are not 100% certain, but it doesn't seem like it is the direct toxic effect of elotuzumab on the myeloma cell that leads to the destruction. It does look like, in my mind, I see it as elotuzumab latches onto the tumor cell, and it sort of acts as a flag for the innate immune system, which is being activated by the lenalidomide to help destroy those myeloma cells. In daratumumab, I think that's a little different. I mean, daratumumab definitely, as a single agent, shows remarkable responses. And in fact, in one of the patients who I gave you as a case, he had received many therapies, including some investigational therapies, and was really sort of like my patient with the CAR T cells, was really progressing and relapsed and really getting very sick from his myeloma. Fortunately, we had opened the single agent daratumumab clinical trial. So he was one of the patients on that trial and just receiving in the standard way that we give daratumumab, the weekly dosing for 8 weeks and then going to every other week for 4 months and then going to monthly, he went into a beautiful remission. And that remission with a single agent daratumumab lasted for about a year and a half, which is pretty remarkable. And so single agent activity was definitely helpful in his case. And again, exactly how single agent activity works, it seems like it's a combination of different immunological events, though there is a direct apoptosis and destruction of the cells by the latching on of the antibody. But in addition, it does seem like it modulates the NK cells and other immune cells to help destroy the myeloma.
At ASCO, we were getting ready to do a myeloma session, and one of the docs in the audience came up and handed me an abstract and said, "What's this all about?" And it was a paper looking at daratumumab and a checkpoint inhibitor, atezolizumab, in lung cancer. What's the thinking there in terms of outside of myeloma?
Well, you know, I can't speak as much for outside of myeloma, but there certainly is the, you know, if you can turn off the anti-immune stimulation, and then also give an immune stimulant, you can see how the whole checkpoint inhibitor story is fascinating and tremendous. I mean, we sometimes forget that our immune system evolved, and it really does come down to evolution, that our immune system evolved to basically destroy foreign invaders, microbes, and things like that. The problem with cancer is that cancer looks very much like us, and our immune system evolved to not kill us, to proliferate and destroy other, but not us. And so the only way, though, that we can use our innate immune system to kill cancer is to sort of turn off the process that protects us. And that's where these checkpoint inhibitors, the whole concept is fascinating and brilliant, and has really remarkably led to beautiful responses in many diseases. And so now we're going the extra step of not only turning off checkpoints, but also stimulating immunity even further.
Your patient who did so well on the daratumumab, this 54-year-old man, how did he do in terms of tolerability? The one thing we've heard about are infusion reactions. I'm curious what happened with him. And also what you know about, what you think about, and whether you've even tried sub-Q Dara.
Infusion reaction, well, In many ways, the biggest issue when it comes to daratumumab is, number one, the potential for infusion reactions or quote-unquote allergic reactions, which leads us to be very cautious, particularly in the initial infusions of these patients, to a very slow infusion, sort of like rituximab, where we start at a very slow rate and then go faster and faster, so that the first infusions can frequently be eight-hour-long infusions. We've learned that there's a number of ways to decrease the likelihood of reactions, and there's a whole standard operating procedure now to decrease that. And I think probably the most important thing has been the use of Singular the day or so before the initiation of the infusion can significantly decrease any respiratory distress or fevers and allow for a more rapid infusion. For the vast majority of patients, though, by the second infusion, the duration of the infusion can be reduced to maybe 5 to 6 hours. And I would say the average infusions are probably 4 to 5 hour infusions at this point and are well tolerated. There is some suggestion that there's an increase in infections in patients who get the monoclonal antibodies. Exactly how that's all sorting itself out is still being determined. But in general, just like as we were saying, daratumumab is now being used in most community practices with a lot of safety and effectiveness. But it's somewhat of a barrier to have a treatment that takes 5 hours of infusion. And so fortunately, there have been clinical trials of the subcutaneous infusion of this agent. In order for that to work, it has to be connected with an enzyme that allows the tissue to sort of break down a little bit to allow for the infusion of this agent. But in early clinical trials, infusions of 30 minutes to an hour and a half have been very safe and equally effective to the longer infusions. And I would guess that we're going to see maybe a transition from these long intravenous infusions to these subcutaneous infusions within the next year or so.
What's the volume of the infusion and where is it given?
It tends to be given in the thigh or in the abdomen. And the volume, it's a real volume, but in the preliminary reports, it has been very well tolerated, not a particularly vesicant or not particularly irritant infusion.
You said you use Singular?
Yeah.
This is the anti-asthma pill?
Yes, yeah, because a bronchospastic toxicity was relatively common in the initial patients, and by doing that sort of the day before, that has significantly reduced that and allowed for the infusions of cells of the daratumumab.
Is that in the package insert? Is that widely done?
I'm not 100% certain, but I think—
I never heard that.
But I think there
I never
is
heard
a—
that.
Yeah, there is a— I don't know if it's in the package insert or whether it's in sort of recommendations of how best to give it.
Huh. Do you think, I mean, honestly, maybe I never thought to ask it or nobody ever sought to mention it. Do you think a lot of investigators do that?
I'm not certain. When it comes to the nuances of administering these agents, we have this whole specialty of our nurse practitioners. And in many ways, our nurses have become the experts when it comes to this.
Interesting.
And are really skilled. Both the chemotherapy nurses and our practitioners have really focused on reducing these toxicities. So I rely on them to really monitor this.
Maybe we can go through some of your other cases. And again, you know, maybe without going through it from A to Z, just kind of say like what basically the situation is and what's sort of the teaching point. So one thing that kind of came out of the blue in myeloma that I wasn't thinking about, we've been talking about venetoclax, obviously, in CLL, mantle cell. Now all of a sudden we're hearing about it in myeloma. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your 56-year-old white male pharmacist.
This has really, in many ways, become the story of our patients with myeloma. And I sort of purposely put him in there for this purpose in that the field keeps evolving so quickly. that even though many of the therapies that we use are not curative, we've been able to find new and novel therapies for patients, even who have really relapsed and refractory disease with conventional therapies, by utilizing the new developments. So daratumumab came just in time, in fact, for him to have a nice response. But nevertheless, after a year and a half, his disease started progressing. And we went through a number of options. But venetoclax, as you know, the BCL-2 inhibitor, has been tremendously effective in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and lymphoma, but particularly chronic lymphocytic leukemia, so effective. Whenever you have a therapy that leads to a tumor lysis syndrome, you know that it's a pretty effective thing. And fortunately, we've been able to manage these patients by watching them closely and anticipating tumor lysis, and the CLL patients have tremendously benefited from it. Well, given that, once again, myeloma is a B-cell malignancy, whenever you have a new therapy for a B-cell malignancy, it's reasonable to think of trying it in multiple myeloma. And, you know, there's a subset. It literally is about 10 to 15% of patients with myeloma who have an 11-14 translocation. And traditionally, we call this the sort of lymphoma phenotype of myeloma. And also traditionally, we've thought of it as not a negative prognostic chromosome abnormality. In fact, it's probably a better prognosis to some extent. But these patients ultimately become resistant and have issues. And so in some preliminary trials of multiple myeloma with the venetoclax, there was a response rate even in patients without an 11-14 translocation, but it became clear very quickly that the subset of patients who had an 11-14 translocation seemed to have a much higher response rate. I think upwards of maybe 40, even 50% of the patients who took single agent venetoclax respond to the agent. And then there are a number of studies that have been adding venetoclax to bortezomib and dexamethasone, et cetera. And so to me, you know, I think it's worthy of investigating in all subsets of myeloma. I think the preponderance of the data now suggests if you have an 11-14 translocation, you have a real chance of responding to this. And so it turns out that the same patient on further review did have an 11-14 translocation. And so once again, his disease was really getting active and very limited options. Fortunately, we were able to obtain on a compassionate basis the venetoclax. And unlike chronic lymphocytic leukemia, the incidence of tumor lysis syndrome has actually been very low in the multiple myeloma experience, and yet some real responses. And so he's been taking 400 milligrams of the venetoclax and has been showing a very nice response, even though other therapies haven't been working.
He's getting venetoclax alone or with bortezomib?
So he's been getting it with bortezomib and dexamethasone. That combination seems to have the highest response rates. And interestingly, the studies show that patients who were refractory, who had been exposed to bortezomib in the past and progressed on it, if you add the venetoclax, then a subset of those patients will respond nicely, even though they were not responding to bortezomib in the past.
Where do you see venetoclax heading, particularly in the subset of 11-14? Are there studies looking at it earlier?
Yes. So there's a number of studies of various combinations. For instance, we are participating in a protocol of venetoclax, carfilzomib, and dexamethasone. So we'll see. Of course, there's always the hope that when you add other agents or do this treatment earlier in the course of the disease, then even patients without the chromosomal abnormality might have responses that are beyond what you'd expect with the conventional therapy. But I definitely see that that subset of patients, which is the minority of myeloma, are the most promising with the treatment of venetoclax. And fortunately, in the myeloma patient population, there's been low toxicity with that agent.
I wanted to ask you about your 54-year-old man who currently is receiving, for relapse disease, exazimib and lenalidomide and dex. And I want to ask you about what happened there. But I noticed something in his history I was curious about, that I guess maybe when he presented, he had bone infarcts. How do they present clinically? What happened with him? What do you see when you see bone infarcts in myeloma?
That's a very good question. I mean, you know, most of the time when we have patients with myeloma, the bony disease that we see is lytic bone lesions, mainly from sort of the cytokines that are released by the plasma cells that lead to the osteoclasts eating holes in the bones. Very occasionally in the POEM syndrome, we see osteosclerotic lesions. I would say the reports of this have been greatest in acute leukemia or maybe lymphoma, like high-grade lymphoma. In bone marrow diseases, even though you think of the bone marrow as a very vascular structure, if you have a very rapidly growing high-risk disease or high-growth rate disease, these cells can outstrip their blood supply, and you can actually get necrosis of the bone marrow. And it's usually a very poor prognostic finding in all diseases, but we see it in myeloma also relatively infrequently. But it's usually a sign of a packed marrow of rapidly growing cells, which, remember, in myeloma, even though we see an aggressiveness to a lot of these diseases, they really don't have as rapid division as certain lymphomas and leukemia. And so seeing a necrosis is really much less common in this disease.
And what do you see clinically? What happened with him? Did they have pain?
Pain. That's usually the main thing that, so it's, I guess, in the differential diagnosis of why people will have pain, it can be a necrosis occurring in the bone marrow. And, you know, sometimes radiation to that area will be helpful. Probably the most important thing is, though, a successful treatment and making the disease better. Depending on where, usually the osteonecrosis occurs not in the joint, but in the longer bones. If it occurs in a joint, though, just like a vascular necrosis, ultimately, if the pain persists, even though the disease is improved, potentially a joint replacement or something like that might be helpful.
So I was curious about your clinical experience with ixazomib. As I mentioned, it looked like that's what he's on right now. What was going on when you started him on therapy, and how did he tolerate it?
Well, as of this moment, you know, I see ixazomib as sort of a alternative to bortezomib. That's the primary way, and I know that it is a completely different medication and potentially has different activities, but most of the clinical data that we have right now is that it is not clearly, though there hasn't been a head-to-head comparison, better or worse than bortezomib. And so the primary use that I have is in people where the convenience of taking an oral agent rather than a subcutaneous agent would warrant it. Occasionally, though, there is a neuropathy associated with ixazomib, similar to the neuropathy in bortezomib, but there's an occasional person who did not tolerate well bortezomib but responded, where I will try ixazomib. I think the data of using the IRD regimen, the ixazomib lenalidomide dexamethasone regimen, early in the course of the disease is excellent. In the patient that we're talking about, it was a patient who had had initial therapy, an autologous stem cell transplant, lenalidomide maintenance therapy. And then when the disease biochemically started progressing, he's a very active guy. He travels a lot. And so rather than using a bortezomib-containing regimen, we decided to initiate the ixazomib lenalidomide dexamethasone at that point. And he's tolerated it very well.
No GI problems.
I wouldn't say no GI problems. That, of course, is, you know, where we think of bortezomib as neuropathy being the primary issue. We think of ixazomib as GI toxicity being the primary issue. But for the majority of patients that we've treated, obviously, depending on what the issue is, some Imodium, sometimes cholestyramine, which has been sort of the miracle agent for lenalidomide diarrhea, sometimes taking an antiemetic, most of the patients are able to tolerate the agent well. Occasionally, we do a dose reduction. You know, 4 milligrams is the standard dose. I have patients on 3 milligrams who tolerate it just fine and have real activity.
And how long has he been on treatment, and how's he responding?
He's responding nicely to it, and I think he's been on it for somewhere in the neighborhood about 5-6 months, something like that.
It's interesting that you chose to really add the ixazomib he was progressing on lenalidomide and dex. Did you increase the dose of the lenalidomide?
He didn't tolerate. Lenalidomide actually gave him more toxicity. And so I did actually, he was on 10 milligrams, which is the standard sort of maintenance. I brought it up to 15 milligrams and added the 4 milligrams of the exazimib and 20 milligrams of dexamethasone. I found, in general, dexamethasone less is more. Remember, so much of myeloma and so much of the decision-making is not so much as much which regimen is going to be the most active, because obviously we want to see responses when we do this. The whole point is that the only reason why we're making changes is because we expect we are going to have a symptomatic progression, and we want to avoid that from happening or turn around the symptoms as quickly as possible. But there's also a very important aspect of durability. We want to be able to get a regimen that patients can take for a long period of time, because if the patients can't tolerate it, then they're not going to benefit from that. And so I'm very much of a tweaker of doses and schedules. And the great thing about myeloma that we've learned is, you know, the full dose on time sort of approach is not as essential in this disease as like acute lymphocytic leukemia or something like that, as making sure that the patient tolerates the regimen for a long period of time.
So it's interesting. So this patient got VRD, RVD, as many people most do, transplant, and then len maintenance, relapse on len maintenance, very common scenario. There are other, and you chose to, you know, add in exazimib, increase the dose of lenalidomide, but there are other approaches to these types of patients. One is to increase the dose of lenalidomide and add ELO. Another is CAR-POM-DEX. There are other combinations that can be considered, and of course, daratumumab. How do you go about deciding specifically what to do for a patient who relapses on len maintenance?
Sure. That's, of course, the $64,000 question. So, and it's the question that we are confronted with virtually every day, multiple times, especially if you have a large myeloma practice. What I do is what I've done for the last 20 years in caring for patients with myeloma. Anytime I have a decision point, what I do is I review all of the treatments that the patients had in the past, whether they responded or didn't respond, but even more importantly, what the toxicities were, to see if patients will tolerate things. I also have a strong philosophy that, unlike maybe breast cancer or lung cancer or other diseases, that each combination of therapy should be thought of as a different drug, that Len-Dex is a different drug than bortezomib Len-Dex, is a different drug than Elo-Len-Dex. They're all, the combination is magic, that there's something to the combination. So then what I do is I list, just like you just did, all the potential options for the patient. And of course, there's a lack of studies, because they're very difficult studies, that look at sequence of regimens. So that's why, until there is more data about sequence, I really think in terms of toxicity. I want to use the same philosophy. I'm looking for regimens that have a high chance of working, that if they work, that there's a high chance that the patient will be able to continue the regimen for a period of time. So you negotiate. It's always a negotiation with the patient. Do they live far away? In which case, oral agents would be better than infusions. Are they frail? In which case, it would be better to have a regimen where they're being seen frequently in the clinic so that you can keep an eye on them and make adjustments quickly. And then some patients, they've had lenalidomide, they've had horrible diarrhea, so there's no way that you should do a lenalidomide. I'm not a very strong believer in classes of medicines, that which I think, again, is maybe a difference in the solid tumor oncology, that if the patient's progressing on an immunomodulatory agent, then you must not use an immunomodulatory agent the next time. I don't think that holds true in myeloma. I think that pomalidomide can be very effective in a patient where lenalidomide has lost its activity. I think there is a lot of data now to suggest that triple therapy is superior to doublets. So if patients can tolerate it, that's why I like the idea of rather, though I do have patients who have just been on lenalidomide and I'll just increase the dose and add some dexamethasone as the initial therapy, but I do think that that is has been proven in randomized trials to be inferior to adding elotuzumab to lenalidomide and dexamethasone, for instance, or bortezomib to lenalidomide and dexamethasone. So I think triple therapy as a rule is better, but you have to take into consideration so much of the patient's preferences. And then occasionally you have to take into consideration insurance and what is covered and what's not covered and what's going to have huge copays and what's not going to have huge copays.
Let's talk a little bit about Waldenstrom's, and maybe we can hear about your 76-year-old man.
Well, you know, Waldenstrom's is a disease, so it's really different from myeloma. I'm a believer that Waldenstrom's is more lymphoma than myeloma, but, you know, it's a low-grade indolent lymphoma that is associated with a monoclonal protein and can be associated and has generally a very indolent course. And I have patients who I've been following for 25 years who have never been on any therapy, but it also can have some very devastating problems of kidney dysfunction and low blood counts and infections and hyperviscosity. So, you know, the hardest or maybe the most important first decision always is, should the patient be treated at all? And in general, I have a slow hand to treat Waldenstrom's patients, that the vast majority of the patients putter around for a long period of time, and they really have to be symptomatic or have a clear evolution of their disease in a negative way for me to start treating them. But fortunately, we've got some really good treatments. Of course, we have the traditional treatments of chemotherapy. And just like any other low-grade lymphoma, the bendamustine-containing regimen like bendamustine and rituximab is a very active and reasonable and relatively well-tolerated regimen. Frequently, I'll start off with rituximab as a single agent. The problem with rituximab as a single agent, though, is there is this bump in the IgM monoclonal protein that occurs relatively frequently after single agent rituximab. So if a patient is borderline hyperviscous to begin with, you have to be very cautious about that. So I'll frequently, if I see someone like that, I'll watch them, of course, very closely, and frequently I'll give them some dexamethasone or maybe even the first time a couple of plasmapheresis procedures to reduce the likelihood that that will happen. When you give chemotherapy along with rituximab, then it significantly decreases the likelihood of that bump in the IgM. In the patient that I presented, however, he received that, but he did not have a particularly prolonged or good response. So we're very fortunate, particularly because of the work of Steve Treon from Dana-Farber, is that it turns out that ibrutinib, again, utilizing a drug that had been created in many ways for chronic lymphocytic leukemia, the MYD88 mutation is very common in Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, and there are tremendous response rates and prolonged responses just by taking 3 pills or so of ibrutinib daily. So that's what this patient did. He received the bendamustine and rituximab, did not have a prolonged response, and so has now been on ibrutinib for a year or so and is doing beautifully. And those sort of responses to ibrutinib with relatively low toxicity and high response rate have led to the debate as to whether ibrutinib should become the first line therapy for, and I believe that there's clinical trials that are ongoing that are looking at this. And I think it's a very reasonable thing to consider, but I guess the great thing about using a chemotherapy approach is that it tends to be a very limited therapy, that you'll receive maybe 6 cycles of something, go into remission, and those remissions can last for years versus taking a continued set of pills indefinitely. And though ibrutinib has been very well tolerated, there's always some potential toxicities of rashes, of bleeding disorders, etc. But I think the outlook for patients with Waldenstrom? Number one, it started off not too horrible to begin with. Less is more, and many of these patients can be monitored for many years. But should they run into trouble, I think we have a number of really good options for them, and that leads to responses that are prolonged and well-tolerated.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You have a 76-year-old man. I mean, he got through the bendamustine rituximab, but he did have some problems. You know, you can imagine somebody 85, 90, or more frail. Are there clinical situations where you would attempt to use ibrutinib up front?
Definitely. No, I think that's a very good point, that given the low toxicity and a pill sort of regimen, it makes a lot of sense to consider frailty, et cetera. Incidentally, my 76-year-old gentleman, he has a 45-year-old girlfriend, so I think he's sort of maybe a special case.
That sounds interesting. Any event? Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, this dilemma about do you want to give short-term rituximab chemo versus ibrutinib, the same argument goes on in the CLL. It's interesting, they still use, particularly for younger patients, chemo rituximab with the idea of avoiding long-term treatment, although other people say, well, hey, it's just another pill.
Yeah, you know, that's for CLL, obviously it's a whole different topic, but yeah, to me, that is one of the harder decisions for a young patient with CLL, you know, like FCR versus doing something else. And so it's an evolving area. Again, as I sort of said, myeloma and for CLL also, toxicity is maybe even more important a determination of what you should give than response, since we see such nice responses with many different agents. And you know, the fludarabine-based regimens really lead to an immunologic dysfunction, and that is sort of lifelong in these patients. And ultimately, that might be a toxicity that we'd like to avoid given the newer agents.
That's interesting. You're saying that the immune suppression from fludarabine lasts after treatment stop?
Yeah, yes. I would say that those sorts of adenosine deaminase inhibitor type medicines really do lead to, they're so good at killing lymphocytes that you can detect real immune dysfunction for years, if not decades, in this group of patients. And, you know, whether that, now that the patients are living longer and longer, is that something that might either limit their therapies in the future or lead to secondary problems in the future?